Marco wanted breakfast primarily because he could smell it. Ham and sausages on the grill somewhere deep in the main house. But Luigi was anxious to move on. "There are other guests, and everyone eats at the same table," he explained as they hurriedly threw their bags in his car. "Remember, you're leaving a trail, and the signora forgets nothing." They sped down the country lane in search of wider roads. "Where are we going?" Marco asked. "We'll see." "Stop playing games with me," he growled, and Luigi actually flinched. "I'm a perfectly free man who could get out of this car any time I want." "Yes, but stop threatening me. Every time I ask a question, you give me these vague threats about how I won't last 24 hours on my own. I want to know what's going on. Where are we headed? How long will we be there? How long will you be around? Give me some answers, Luigi, or I'll disappear." Luigi turned onto a four-lane, and a sign said that Bologna was 30 kilometers ahead. He waited for the tension to ease a bit, then said, "We're going to Bologna for a few days. Ermanno will meet us there. You will continue your lessons. You'll be placed in a safe house for several months. Then I'll disappear, and you'll be on your own." "Thank you. Why was that so difficult?" "The plan changes." I knew Ermanno wasn't a student. "He is a student. He's also part of the plan." "Do you realize how ridiculous the plan is? Think about it, Luigi. Someone is spending all this time and money trying to teach me another language and another culture. Why not just put me back on the cargo plane and stash me in some place like New Zealand?" "That's a great idea, Marco, but I'm not making those decisions." "Marco, my ass. Every time I look in the mirror and say Marco, I want to laugh. This is not funny. Do you know Robert Kritz?" Marco paused for a moment. "I met him a few times over the years. Never had much use for him. Just another political hack like me, I guess. Close friend of President Morgan. Chief of staff. Campaign director. So? He was killed last night in London. That makes 5 people who've died because of you. J.C. Hubbard, the 3 Pakistanis, now Kritz. The killing hasn't stopped, Marco, nor will it. Please be patient with me. I'm only trying to protect you." Marco slammed his head into the headrest and closed his eyes. He could not begin to put the pieces together. They made a quick exit and stopped for gas. Luigi returned to the car with 2 small cups of strong coffee. "Coffee to go," Marco said pleasantly. "I figure such evils would be banned in Italy. Fast food is creeping in. It's very sad. Just blame the Americans. Everybody else does." Before long, they were inching through the rush hour traffic on the outskirts of Bologna. Luigi was saying, "Our best cars are made around here, you know. Ferraris, Lamborghinis, Maseratis, all the great sports cars. Can I have one?" "It's not in the budget, sorry." "What exactly is in the budget?" "A very quiet, simple life." "That's what I thought." "Much better than your last one." Marco sipped his coffee and watched the traffic. "Didn't you study here?" "Yes, the university is 1,000 years old, one of the finest in the world. I'll show it to you later." They exited the main thoroughfare and wound through a gritty suburb. The streets became shorter and narrower, and Luigi seemed to know the place well. They followed the signs pointing them toward the center of the city and the university. Luigi suddenly swerved, jumped a curb, and wedged the Fiat into a slot barely wide enough for a motorcycle. "Let's eat something," he said. And once they managed to squeeze themselves out of the car, they were on the sidewalk, walking quickly through the cool air. Marco's next hiding place was a dingy hotel a few blocks from the outer edge of the old city. "Budget cuts already," he mumbled as he followed Luigi through the cramped lobby to the stairs. "It's just for a few days," Luigi said. "Then what?" Marco was struggling with his bags up the narrow stairway. Luigi was carrying nothing. Thankfully, the room was on the second floor, a rather small space with a tiny bed and curtains that hadn't been opened in days. "I like Treviso better," Marco said, staring at the walls. Luigi yanked open the curtains. The sunlight helped only slightly. "Not bad," he said without conviction. "My prison cell was nicer." "You complain a lot." "With good reason. Unpack. I'll meet you downstairs in 10 minutes. Hermano is waiting." Hermano appeared as rattled as Marco by the sudden change in location. He was harried and unsettled, as if he had chased them all night from Treviso. They walked with him a few blocks to a rundown apartment building. No elevators were evident, so they climbed 4 flights of stairs and entered a tiny 2-room flat that had even less furniture than the apartment in Treviso. Hermano had obviously packed in a hurry and unpacked even faster. "Your dump's worse than mine," Marco said, taking it in. Spread on a narrow table and waiting for action were the study materials they had used the day before. "I'll be back for lunch," Luigi said, and quickly disappeared.
"Andiamo a studiare,"
Hermano announced. "Let's study." "I've already forgotten everything."
"But we had a good session yesterday."
"Can't we just go to a bar and drink? I'm really not in the mood for this." But Hermano had assumed his position across the table and was turning pages in his manual. Marco reluctantly settled into the seat across from him. Lunch and dinner were forgettable. Both were quick snacks in fake trattorias, the Italian version of fast food. Luigi was in a foul mood and insisted, quite harshly at times, that they speak only Italian. Luigi spoke slowly, clearly, and repeated everything 4 times until Marco figured it out. Then he moved along to the next phrase. It was impossible to enjoy food under such pressure. At midnight, Marco was in his bed in his cold room, wrapped tightly with the thin blanket, sipping orange juice he had ordered himself, and memorizing list after list of verbs and adjectives. What could Robert Kritz have possibly done to get himself killed by people who might also be looking for Joel Backman? The question itself was too bizarre to ask. He couldn't begin to contemplate an answer. He assumed Kritz was present when the pardon was granted. Ex-President Morgan was incapable of making such a decision by himself. Beyond that, though, it was impossible to see Kritz involved at a higher level. He had proven for decades that he was nothing more than a good hatchet man. Very few people trusted him. But if people were still dying, then it was urgent that he learn the verbs and adjectives scattered on his bed. Language meant survival and movement. Luigi and Hermano would soon disappear, and Marco Lazzari would be left to fend for himself. Chapter 12. Marco escaped his claustrophobic room, or apartment as it was called, and went for a long walk at daybreak. The sidewalks were almost as damp as the frigid air. With a pocket map Luigi had given him, all in Italian of course, he made his way into the old city, and once past the ruins of the ancient walls at Porta San Donato, he headed west on Via Irnerio, along the north edge of the university section of Bologna. The sidewalks were centuries old and covered with what appeared to be miles of arching porticos. Evidently, street life began late in the university section. An occasional car passed, then a bike or two, but the foot traffic was still asleep. Luigi had explained that Bologna had a history of left-wing communist leanings. It was a rich history, one that Luigi promised to explore with him. Ahead, Marco saw a small green neon sign that was indifferently advertising the Bar Fontana, and as he walked toward it, he soon picked up the scent of strong coffee. The bar was wedged tightly into the corner of an ancient building, but then they were all ancient. The door opened reluctantly, and once inside, Marco almost smiled at the aromas: coffee, cigarettes, pastries, breakfast on a grill in the rear. Then the fear hit. The usual apprehension of trying to order in an unknown language. Bar Fontana was not for students or for women. The crowd was his age, 50 and up, somewhat oddly dressed, with enough pipes and beards to identify it as a hangout for faculty. One or two glanced his way, but in the center of a university with 100,000 students, it was difficult for anyone to draw attention. Marco got the last small table near the back, and when he finally nestled into his spot with his back to the wall, he was practically shoulder to shoulder with his new neighbors, both of whom were lost in their morning papers and neither of whom appeared to notice him. In one of Luigi's lectures on Italian culture, he had explained the concept of space in Europe and how it differed significantly from that in the States. Space is shared in Europe, not protected. Tables are shared. The air evidently is shared because smoking bothered no one. Cars, houses, buses, apartments, cafes, so many important aspects of life are smaller, thus more cramped, thus more willingly shared. It's not offensive to go nose to nose with an acquaintance during routine conversation because no space is being violated. Talk with your hands, hug, embrace, even kiss at times. Even for a friendly people, such familiarity was difficult for Americans to understand. And Marco was not yet prepared to yield too much space. He picked up the wrinkled menu on the table and quickly settled on the first thing he recognized. Just as the waiter stopped and glanced down at him, he said with all the ease he could possibly exude, "Espresso e un panino al formaggio," a small cheese sandwich. The waiter nodded his approval. Not a single person glanced over to check out his accented Italian. No newspapers dipped to see who he might be. No one cared. They heard accents all the time. As he placed the menu back on the table, Marco Lazzari decided that he probably liked Bologna, even if it turned out to be a nest for communists. With so many students and faculty coming and going, and from all over the world, foreigners were accepted as part of the culture. Perhaps it was rather cool to have an accent and dress differently. Perhaps it was okay to openly study the language. One sign of a foreigner was that he noticed everything, his eyes darting around as if he knew he was trespassing into a new culture and didn't want to get caught. Marco would not be caught taking in the sights in the Bar Fontana. He removed a booklet of vocabulary sheets and tried mightily to ignore the people and scenes he wanted to watch. Verbs, verbs, verbs. Ermanno kept saying that to master Italian, or any romance language for that matter, you had to know the verbs. The booklet had 1,000 of the basic verbs, and Ermanno claimed that it was a good starting point. As tedious as rote memorization was, Marco was finding an odd pleasure in it. He found it quite satisfying to zip through 4 pages, 100 verbs or nouns or anything for that matter, and not miss a one. When he got one wrong or missed a pronunciation, he went back to the beginning and punished himself by starting over. He had conquered 300 verbs when his coffee and sandwich arrived. He took a sip, went back to work as if the food was much less important than the vocab, and was somewhere over 400 when Rudolph arrived. The chair on the other side of Marco's small round table was vacant, and this caught the attention of a short, fat man dressed entirely in faded black, with wild bunches of gray, frizzy hair protruding from all parts of his head, some of it barely suppressed by a black beret that somehow managed to stay aboard.
"Buongiorno, è libera?"
he asked politely, gesturing toward the chair. Marco wasn't sure what he said, but it was obvious what he wanted. Then he caught the word libera and assumed it meant free or vacant. "Sì," Marco managed with no accent, and the man removed a long black cape, draped it over the chair, then maneuvered himself into position. When he came to rest, they were less than 3 feet apart. "Space is different here," Marco kept telling himself. The man placed a copy of L'Unità on the table, making it rock back and forth. For an instant, Marco was worried about his espresso. To avoid conversation, he buried himself even deeper into Ermanno's verbs. "American?" his new friend said in English with no foreign accent. Marco lowered the booklet and looked into the glowing eyes not far away. "Close. Canadian." "How'd you know?" He nodded at the booklet and said,
"English to Italian vocabulary. You don't look British, so I figure you're American."
Judging by his accent, He was probably not from the upper Midwest, not from New York or New Jersey, not from Texas or the South or Appalachia or New Orleans. As vast sections of the country were eliminated, Marco was beginning to think of California, and he was beginning to get very nervous. The lying would soon start, and he hadn't practiced enough. "And where are you from?" he asked.
"Last stop was Austin, Texas. That was 30 years ago. Name's Rudolph."
"Good morning, Rudolph. A pleasure. I'm Marco." They were in kindergarten, where only first names were needed. "You don't sound Texan."
"Thank God for that,"
he said with a pleasant laugh, one that barely revealed his mouth.
"Originally from San Francisco."
The waiter leaned in and Rudolph ordered black coffee, then something else in rapid Italian. The waiter had a follow-up, as did Rudolph, and Marco understood none of it.
"What brings you to Bologna?" Rudolph asked.
He seemed anxious to chat, probably rare that he cornered a fellow North American in his favorite café. Marco lowered his booklet and said, "Just traveling around Italy for a year, seeing the sights, trying to pick up some of the language." Half of Rudolph's face was covered with an unkempt gray beard that began fairly high up the cheekbones and sprang in all directions. Most of his nose was visible, as was part of his mouth. For some odd reason, one that no one would ever understand because no one would ever dare ask such a ridiculous question, he had developed the habit of shaving a small round spot under his lower lip and comprising most of his upper chin. Other than that sacred ground, the wild frizzy whiskers were allowed to run free and apparently go unwashed. The top of his head was pretty much the same, acres of untouched bright gray brush sprouting from all around the beret. Because so many of his features were masked, his eyes got all the attention. They were dark green and projected rays that from under a set of thick, sagging eyebrows took in everything.
"How long in Bologna?" Rudolph asked.
"Got here yesterday. I have no schedule. And you? What brings you here?" Marco was anxious to keep the conversation away from himself. The eyes danced and never blinked.
"I've been here for 30 years. I'm a professor at the university."
Marco finally took a bite of his cheese sandwich, partly out of hunger, but more importantly, to keep Rudolph talking.
"Where's your home?" he asked.
Following the script, Marco said, "Toronto. Grandparents immigrated there from Milan. I have Italian blood, but never learned the language."
"The language is not hard," Rudolph said, and his coffee arrived.
He grabbed the small cup and thrust it deep into the beard. Evidently, it found his mouth. He smacked his lips and leaned forward a bit as though he wanted to talk.
"You don't sound Canadian," he said, and those eyes appeared to be laughing at him.
Marco was struggling under the labor of looking, acting, and sounding Italian. He had had no time to even think about putting on Canadian airs. How exactly does one sound Canadian? He took another bite, a huge one, and through his food said,
"Can't help that."
"How did you get here from Austin?"
"A long story."
Marco shrugged as if he had plenty of time.
"I was once a young professor at the University of Texas Law School. When they found out I was a communist, they began pressuring me to leave. I fought them, they fought back. I got louder, especially in the classroom. Communists didn't fare too well in Texas in the early 70s. Doubt if much has changed. They denied me tenure, ran me out of town, so I came here to Bologna, the heart of Italian communism."
"What do you teach here?"
"Jurisprudence, law. Radical left-wing legal theories."
A powdered brioche of some sort arrived, and Rudolph ate half of it with the first bite. A few crumbs dropped from the depths of his beard.
"Still a communist?" Marco asked. "Of course, always. Why would I change?"
"Seems to have run its course, don't you think? Not such a great idea after all. I mean, look at what a mess Russia is in because of Stalin and his legacy. And North Korea? They're starving there while the dictator builds nuclear warheads. Cuba is 50 years behind the rest of the world. The Sandinistas were voted out in Nicaragua. China is turning to free market capitalism because the old system broke down. It really doesn't work, does it?" The brioche had lost its appeal. The green eyes were narrow. Marco could see a tirade coming, probably one laced with obscenities in both English and Italian. He glanced around quickly and realized that there was a very good chance the communists had him outnumbered in the Bar Fontana. And what had capitalism done for him? Much to his credit, Rudolph smiled and shrugged and said with an air of nostalgia, "Maybe so. But it sure was fun being a communist 30 years ago, especially in Texas. Those were the days." Marco nodded at the newspaper and said, "Ever read papers from home?" "Home is here, my friend. I became an Italian citizen and haven't been back to the States in 20 years. Backman was relieved. He had not seen American newspapers since his release, but he assumed there had been coverage, probably old photos as well. His past seemed safe from Rudolph. Marco wondered if that was his future, Italian citizenship, if any at all. Fast forward 20 years, and would he still be drifting through Italy, not exactly glancing over his shoulder, but always thinking about it? "You said home," Rudolph interrupted. "Is that the U.S. or Canada?" Marco smiled and nodded to a far-off place. "Over there, I guess." A small mistake, but one that should not have been made. To quickly shift to another subject, he said, "This is my first visit to Bologna. Didn't know it was the center of Italian communism." Rudolph lowered his cup and made a smacking sound with his partially concealed lips. Then with both hands he gently pawed his beard backward, much like an old cat slicking down his whiskers. "Bologna is a lot of things, my friend," he said, as if a lengthy lecture was starting. "It's always been the center of free thought and intellectual activity in Italy. Thus its first nickname, La Dotta, which means the learned. Then it became the home of the political left and received its second nickname, La Rossa, the red. And the Bolognesi have always been very serious about their food. They believe, and they're probably right, that this is the stomach of Italy. Thus the third nickname of La Grassa, the fat. An affectionate term because you won't see many overweight people here. Me, I was fat when I arrived." He patted his stomach proudly with one hand while finishing off the brioche with the other. A frightening question suddenly hit Marco. Was it possible that Rudolph was part of the static? Was he a teammate of Luigi and Ermanno and Stennett and whoever else was out there in the shadows working so hard to keep Joel Backman alive? Surely not. Surely he was what he said he was, a professor, an oddball, a misfit, an aging communist who had found a better life somewhere else. The thought passed, but it was not forgotten. Marco finished his little sandwich and decided they'd talked enough. He suddenly had a train to catch for another day of sightseeing. He managed to extricate himself from the table and got a fond farewell from Rudolph. "I'm here every morning," he said. "Come back when you can stay longer." "Grazie," Marco said. "Arrivederci." Outside the cafe, Via Irnerio was stirring to life as small delivery vans began their routes. Two of the drivers yelled at each other, probably friendly obscenities Marco would never understand. He hustled away from the cafe, just in case old Rudolph thought of something else to ask him and came charging out. He turned down a side street, Via Capo di Luca. He was learning that they were well marked and easy to find on his map, and zigzagged his way toward the center. He passed another cozy little cafe, then backtracked and ducked inside for a cappuccino. No communists bothered him there. No one seemed to even notice him. Marco and Joel Backman savored the moment. The delicious strong drink, the warm, thick air, the quiet laughter of those doing the talking. Right now, not a single person in the world knew exactly where he was, and it was indeed an exhilarating feeling. At Marco's insistence, the morning sessions were beginning at 8, not 30 minutes later. Ermanno, the student, still needed long hours of hard sleep but he couldn't argue with his pupil's intensity. Marco arrived for each lesson with his vocabulary lists thoroughly memorized, his situational dialogues perfected, and his urgent desire to absorb the language barely under control. At one point, he suggested they begin at 7. The morning he met Rudolph, Marco studied intensely for 2 uninterrupted hours, then abruptly said, "Vorrei vedere l'università. I'd like to see the university."
"Quando?"
Ermanno asked. "When?"
"Adesso. Andiamo a fare una passeggiata."
"Now, let's go for a walk."
"Penso che dobbiamo studiare."
"I think we should study."
"Sì, possiamo studiare a camminando."
"We can study while we're walking." Marco was already on his feet, grabbing his coat. They left the depressing building and headed in the general direction of the university.
"Questa via, come si chiama?"
Ermanno asked. "What's the name of this street?"
"È Via Donati,"
Marco answered without looking for a street sign. They stopped in front of a small, crowded shop and Ermanno asked,
"Che tipo di negozio è questo?"
"What kind of store is this?"
"Una tabaccheria,"
a tobacco store.
"Che cosa puoi comprare in questo negozio?"
"What can you buy here?"
"Posso comprare molte cose.
Giornali, riviste, francobolli, sigarette." "I can buy many things. Newspapers, magazines, stamps, cigarettes." The session became a roving game of name that thing. Ermanno would point and say,
"Cosa è quello?"
"What's that? A bike, a policeman, a blue car, a city bus, a bench, a garbage can, a student, a telephone booth, a small dog, a cafe, a pastry shop." Except for a lamppost, Marco was quick with the Italian word for each. And the all-important verbs, walking, talking, seeing, studying, buying, thinking, chatting, breathing, eating, drinking, hurrying, driving. The list was endless, and Marco had the proper translations at his disposal. A few minutes after 10, and the university was finally coming to life. Ermanno explained that there was no central campus, no American-style quadrangle lined with trees and such. The Università degli Studi was found in dozens of handsome old buildings, some 500 years old, most of them packed end-to-end along Via Zamboni, though over the centuries the school had grown and now covered an entire section of Bologna. The Italian lesson was forgotten for a block or two, as they were swept along in a wave of students hustling to and from their classes. Marco caught himself looking for an old man with bright gray hair, his favorite communist, his first real acquaintance since walking out of prison. He had already made up his mind to see Rudolph again. At 22 Via Zamboni, Marco stopped and gazed at a sign between the door and a window. "Facoltà di Giurisprudenza." "Is this the law school?" he asked.
"Sì."
Rudolph was somewhere inside, no doubt spreading left-wing dissent among his impressionable students. They ambled on, in no hurry, as they continued to play Name That Thing and enjoy the energy of the street. Chapter 13. The lezione a piede, lesson on foot, continued the next day when Marco revolted after an hour of tedious grammar straight from the textbook and demanded to go for a walk.
"Ma deve imparare la grammatica,"
Ermanno insisted. "You must learn grammar." Marco was already putting on his coat. "That's where you're wrong, Ermanno. I need real conversation, not sentence structure."
"Sono io l'insegnante."
"I am the teacher."
"Let's go. Andiamo. Bologna is waiting. The streets are filled with happy young people. The air is alive with the sounds of your language, all just waiting for me to absorb."
When Ermanno hesitated, Marco smiled at him and said, "Please, my friend. I've been locked in a small cell about the size of this apartment for 6 years. You can't expect me to stay here. There's a vibrant city out there. Let's go explore it." Outside, the air was clear and brisk, not a cloud anywhere, a gorgeous winter day that drew every warm-blooded Bolognese into the streets for errands and long-winded chats with old friends. Pockets of intense conversation materialized as sleepy-eyed students greeted each other and housewives gathered to trade the gossip. Elderly gentlemen dressed in coats and ties shook hands and then all talked at once. Street merchants called out with their latest bargains. But for Hermano, it was not a walk in the park. If his student wanted conversation, then he would certainly earn it. He pointed to a policeman and said to Marco, in Italian, of course,
"Go to that policeman and ask directions for the Piazza Maggiore. Get them right, then repeat them to me."
Marco walked very slowly, whispering some words, trying to recall others. "Always start with a smile and the proper greeting." "Buongiorno," he said, almost holding his breath.
"Buongiorno,"
answered the policeman.
"Mi puoi aiutare? Can you help me?"
"Certamente, certainly."
"Sono canadese. Non parlo molto bene."
"I'm Canadian. I don't speak Italian very well."
"Allora."
"Okay." The policeman was still smiling, now quite anxious to help.
"Dove la Piazza Maggiore?"
The policeman turned and gazed into the distance toward the central part of Bologna. He cleared his throat and Marco braced for the torrent of directions. Just a few feet away and listening to every sound was Hermano. With a beautifully slow cadence, he said in Italian and pointing, of course, the way they all do,
"It's not too far away. Take this street. Turn at the next right. That's Via Zamboni. Follow it until you see the two towers. Turn on Via Rizzoli and go for 3 blocks.
Marco listened as hard as possible, then tried to repeat each phrase. The policeman patiently went through the exercise again. Marco thanked him, repeated as much as he could to himself, then unloaded it on Hermano.
"Non c'è male," he said.
"Not bad." The fun was just starting. As Marco was enjoying his little triumph, Hermano was searching for the next unsuspecting tutor. He found him in an old man shuffling by on a cane and with a thick newspaper under his arm.
"Ask him where he bought the newspaper,"
he instructed his student. Marco took his time, followed the gentleman for a few steps, and when he thought he had the words together, he said,
"Buongiorno, scusi."
The old man stopped and stared, and for a moment looked as though he might lift his cane and whack it across Marco's head. He did not offer the customary buongiorno.
"Dove ha comprato questo giornale?"
"Where did you buy this newspaper?" The old man looked at the newspaper as if it were contraband, then looked at Marco as if he had cursed him. He jerked his head to the left and said something like,
"Over there."
And his part of the conversation was over. As he shuffled away, Hermano eased beside Marco and said in English,
"Not much for conversation, huh?"
"I guess not." They stepped inside a small cafe where Marco ordered a simple espresso for himself. Hermano could not be content with simple things. Instead, he wanted regular coffee with sugar but without cream and a small cherry pastry. And he made Marco order everything and get it perfect. At their table, Hermano laid out several euro notes of various denominations, along with the coins for 50 cents and 1 euro, and they practiced numbers and counting. He then decided he wanted another regular coffee, this time with no sugar, but just a little cream. Marco took 2 euros and came back with the coffee. He counted the change. After the brief break, they were back on the street, drifting along Via San Vitale, one of the main avenues of the university, with porticos covering the sidewalks on both sides and thousands of students jostling to early classes. The street was crammed with bicycles, the preferred mode of getting around. Hermano had been studying for 3 years in Bologna, so he said, though Marco believed little of what he heard from either his tutor or his handler.
"This is Piazza Verdi," Hermano said, nodding to a small plaza where a protest of some sort was stuttering to a start.
A long-haired relic from the 70s was adjusting a microphone, no doubt prepping for a screeching denunciation of American misdeeds somewhere. His cohorts were trying to unravel a large, badly painted homemade banner with a slogan not even Hermano could understand. But they were too early. The students were half asleep and more concerned with being late for class. What's their problem? Marco asked as they walked by.
I'm not sure. Something to do with the World Bank. There's always a demonstration here.
They walked on, flowing with the young crowd, picking their way through the foot traffic and headed generally to Il Centro. Luigi met them for lunch at a restaurant called Testorino, near the university. With American taxpayers footing the bill, he ordered often and with no regard for price. Ermanno, the broke student, seemed ill at ease with such extravagance, but being an Italian, he eventually warmed to the idea of a long lunch. It lasted for 2 hours, and not a single word of English was spoken. The Italian was slow, methodical, and often repeated, but it never yielded to English. Marco found it difficult to enjoy a fine meal when his brain was working overtime to hear, grasp, digest, understand, and plot a response to the last phrase thrown at him. Often the last phrase had passed over his head with only a word or two being somewhat recognizable when the whole thing was suddenly chased by another, and his two friends were not just chatting for the fun of it. If they caught the slightest hint that Marco was not following, that he was simply nodding so they would keep talking so he could eat a bite, then they stopped abruptly and said,
"Che cosa ho detto? What did I say?"
Marco would chew for a few seconds, buying time to think of something, in Italian, damn it, that might get him off the hook. He was learning to listen, though, to catch the key words. Both of his friends had repeatedly said that he would always understand much more than he could say. The food saved him. Of particular importance was the distinction between tortellini, small pasta stuffed with pork, and tortelloni, large pasta stuffed with ricotta cheese. The chef, upon realizing that Marco was a Canadian very curious about Bolognese cuisine, insisted on serving both dishes. As always, Luigi explained that both were exclusively the creations of the great chefs of Bologna. Marco simply ate, trying his best to devour the delicious servings while avoiding the Italian language. After 2 hours, Marco insisted on a break. He finished his second espresso and said goodbye. He left them in front of the restaurant and walked away, alone, his ears ringing and his head spinning from the workout. He made a 2-block loop off Via Rizzoli. Then he did it again to make sure no one was following. The long porticoed walkways were ideal for ducking and hiding. When they were thick with students again, he crossed Piazza Verdi, where the World Bank protest had yielded to a fiery speech that, for a moment, made Marco quite happy he could not understand Italian. He stopped at 22 Via Zamboni and once again looked at the massive wooden door that led to the law school. He walked through it and tried his best to appear as if this was his turf. No directory was in sight, but a student bulletin board advertised apartments, books, companionship, almost everything, it seemed, including a summer studies program at Wake Forest Law School. Through the hallway, the building yielded to an open courtyard where students were milling around, chatting on cell phones, smoking, waiting for classes. A stairway to his left caught his attention. He climbed to the third floor, where he finally located a directory of sorts. He understood the word Uffici and followed a corridor past 2 classrooms until he found the faculty offices. Most had names, a few did not. The last belonged to Rudolf Viscovich, so far the only non-Italian name in the building. Marco knocked, and no one answered. He twisted the knob, but the door was locked. He quickly removed from his coat pocket a sheet of paper he had taken from the Albergo Campiol in Treviso and scribbled a note. "Dear Rudolph, I was wandering around the campus, stumbled upon your office, and wanted to say hello. Maybe I'll catch you again at the Bar Fontana. Enjoyed our chat yesterday. Nice to hear English occasionally. Your Canadian friend, Marco Lazzari." He slid it under the door and walked down the stairs behind a group of students. Back on Via Zamboni, he drifted along with no particular destination in mind. He stopped for a gelato, then slowly made his way back to his hotel. His dark little room was too cold for a nap. He promised himself again that he would complain to his handler. Lunch had cost more than 3 nights' worth of his room. Surely Luigi and those above him could spring for a nicer place. He dragged himself back to Hermano's cupboard-sized apartment for the afternoon session. Luigi waited patiently at Bologna Centrale for the nonstop Eurostar from Milano. The train station was relatively quiet, the lull before the 5 o'clock rush hour. At 3:35, precisely on schedule, the sleek bullet blew in for a quick stop and Whitaker bounced off. Since Whitaker never smiled, they barely said hello. After a cursory handshake was complete, they walked to Luigi's Fiat.
"How's our boy?"
Whitaker asked as soon as he slammed the door.
"Doing fine,"
Luigi said as he started the engine and drove away.
"He's studying hard. There's not much else for him to do."
"And he's staying close?"
"Yes, he likes to walk around the city, but he's afraid to venture too far. Plus, he has no money."
"Keep him broke. How's his Italian?"
"He's learning rapidly."
They were on the Via dell'Indipendenza, a wide avenue that was taking them directly south into the center of the city.
"Very motivated."
"Is he scared?"
"I think so."
"He's smart, and he's a manipulator, Luigi. Don't forget that. And because he's smart, he's also very frightened. He knows the danger."
"I told him about Kritz."
"And?"
"He was bewildered."
"Did it scare him?"
"Yes, I think so." "Who got Kritz?"
"I'm assuming we did, but you never know."
"Is the safe house ready?"
"Yes."
"Good.
Let's see Marco's apartment."
Via Fondazza was a quiet residential street in the southeast section of the old city, a few blocks south of the university section. As in the rest of Bologna, the walkways on both sides of the street were covered with porticos. Doors to the homes and apartments opened directly onto the sidewalks. Most had building directories on brass plaques next to intercoms, but the one at 112 Via Fondazza did not. It was unmarked, and had been for the 3 years it had been leased to a mysterious businessman in Milan who paid the rent but seldom used it. Whitaker had not seen it in more than a year, not that it was much of an attraction. It was a simple apartment of about 600 square feet, 4 rooms with basic furnishings that cost 1,200 euros a month. It was a safe house, nothing more or less, one of 3 currently under his control in northern Italy. There were 2 bedrooms, a tiny kitchen, and a living area with a sofa, a desk, 2 leather chairs, no television. Luigi pointed to the phone and they discussed, in near-coded language, the bugging device that had been installed and could never be detected. There were 2 hidden mics in each room, powerful little collectors that missed no human sound. There were also 2 microscopic cameras, 1 hidden in a crack of an old tile high above the den, and from there it offered a view of the front door. The other was hidden in a cheap light fixture hanging from a kitchen wall with a clear view of the rear door. They would not be watching his bedroom, and Luigi said he was relieved by that. If Marco managed to find a woman willing to visit him, they could catch her coming and going with the camera in the den, and that was certainly enough for Luigi. If he got really bored, he could hit a switch and listen for fun. The safe house was bordered to the south by another apartment with a thick stone wall separating the two. Luigi was staying there, hiding next door in a 5-room flat slightly larger than Marco's. His rear door opened into a small garden that could not be seen from the safe house, thus concealing his movements. His kitchen had been converted into a high-tech snooping room where he could switch on a camera anytime he wanted and take a look at what was happening next door.
"Will they study here?"
Whitaker asked.
"Yes, I think it's secure enough. Plus, I can monitor things."
Whitaker walked through each room again. When he had seen enough, he said,
"Everything set up next door?"
"Everything.
I've spent the last 2 nights there."
"We're ready."
"How soon can you move him?"
"This afternoon."
"Very well. Let's go see the boy."
They walked north along Via Fondazza until it came to an end, then northwest along a wider avenue, Strada Maggiore. The rendezvous point was a small cafe called Lestre's. Luigi found a newspaper and sat alone at a table. Whitaker found another newspaper and sat nearby, each man ignoring the other. At precisely 4:30, Ermanno and his student stopped by for a quick espresso with Luigi. When the greetings were exchanged and the coats removed, Luigi asked, "Are you tired of Italian, Marco?"
"I'm sick of it," Marco replied with a smile.
"Good. Let's talk English."
"God bless you," Marco said. Whitaker sat 5 feet away, partially hidden behind a newspaper, smoking a cigarette as if he had no interest in anyone around him. He, of course, knew of Ermanno, but had never actually seen him. Marco was another story. Whitaker had been in Washington for a stint at Langley a dozen or so years earlier, back when everyone knew the broker. He remembered Joel Backman as a political force who spent almost as much time cultivating his oversized image as he did representing his important clients. He had been the epitome of money and power, the perfect fat cat who could bully and cajole and throw around enough money to get whatever he wanted. Amazing what 6 years in prison could do. He was very thin now and looking quite European behind the Armani eyewear. He had the beginnings of a salt-and-pepper goatee. Whitaker was certain that virtually no one from back home could walk into Lestri's at that moment and identify Joel Backman. Marco caught the man 5 feet away, glancing over one time too often, but thought nothing of it. They were chatting in English, and perhaps few people did so, at Lestri's anyway. Nearer the university, one could hear several languages in every coffee shop. Ermanno excused himself after one espresso. A few minutes later, Whitaker left too. He walked a few blocks and found an internet cafe, one he had used before. He plugged in his laptop, got online, and typed a message to Julia Javier at Langley. "Fondazza Flat is ready to go. Should move in tonight. Laid eyes on our man, having a coffee with our friends. Would not have known him otherwise. Adjusting nicely to a new life. All is in order here. No problems whatsoever." After dark, the Fiat stopped in the middle of Via Fondazza, and its contents were quickly unloaded. Marco packed light because he owned practically nothing. 2 bags of clothes and some Italian study books, and he was completely mobile. When he stepped into his new apartment, the first thing he noticed was that it was sufficiently heated. "This is more like it," he said to Luigi. "I'll move the car. Have a look around." He looked around, counted 4 rooms with nice furnishings, nothing extravagant, but a huge step up from the last place. Life was improving. 10 days ago, he had been in prison. Luigi returned in a rush. "What do you think?"
"I'll keep it, thank you."
"Don't mention it. And thank the folks in Washington, too."
"Did you see the kitchen?" Luigi asked, flipping on a light switch.
"Yes, it's perfect. How long do I stay here, Luigi?"
"I don't make those decisions, you know that."
"I know."
They were back in the den.
"A couple of things," Luigi said.
"First, Ermanno will come here each day to help you study. 8 until 11, then 2 until 5 or whenever you wish to stop."
"Wonderful.
Please get the boy a new flat, would you? His dump is an embarrassment to the American taxpayers.
Second, this is a very quiet street, mainly apartments. Come and go quickly. Don't chat with your neighbors. Don't make any friends. Remember, Marco, you are leaving a trail. Make it wide enough and someone will find you."
"I heard you the first 10 times.
"Then hear me again."
"Relax, Luigi. My neighbors will never see me, I promise. I like it here. It's much nicer than my prison cell."
Chapter 14. The memorial service for Robert Kritz was held in a country club-like mausoleum in a ritzy suburb of Philadelphia, the city of his birth, but a place he had avoided for at least the past 30 years. He died without a will and without a thought as to his final arrangements, leaving poor Mrs. Kritz with the burden of not only getting him home from London, but then deciding how to properly dispose of him. A son pressed the idea of cremation and a rather neat interment in a marble vault, one shielded from the weather. By that point, Mrs. Kritz would have agreed to almost any plan. flying 7 hours across the Atlantic in coach with her husband's remains somewhere below her in a rather stark air transport box made especially for dead humans, had nearly pushed her over the edge. And then there had been the chaos at the airport when no one was there to greet her and take charge. What a mess. The service was by invitation only, a condition laid down by former President Arthur Morgan, who, after only 2 weeks on Barbados, was quite unwilling to return and be seen by anyone. If he was truly saddened by the death of his lifelong friend, he didn't show it. He had haggled over the details of the service with the Critz family until he was almost asked to stay away. The date had been moved because of Morgan. The order of service didn't suit him. He reluctantly agreed to deliver a eulogy, but only if it could be very brief. Truth was, he had never liked Mrs. Critz, and she had never liked him. To the small circle of friends and family, it seemed implausible that Robert Critz would get so drunk in a London pub that he would stagger into a busy street and fall in front of a car. When the autopsy revealed a significant level of heroin, Mrs. Critz had become so distraught that she insisted that the report be sealed and buried. She had refused to tell even her children about the narcotic. She was absolutely certain her husband had never touched an illicit drug. He drank too much, but few people knew it. But she nonetheless was determined to protect his good name. The London police had readily agreed to lock away the autopsy findings and close the case. They had their questions all right, but they had many other cases to keep them busy, and they also had a widow who couldn't wait to get home and put it all behind her. The service began at 2 on a Thursday afternoon. The time also dictated by Morgan so that the private jet could fly nonstop from Barbados to Philly International and lasted for an hour. 82 people had been invited and 51 showed up. A fair majority of them more curious to see President Morgan than to say goodbye to old Critz. A semi-Protestant minister of some variety presided. Critz had not seen the inside of a church in 40 years, except for weddings and funerals. The minister was faced with the difficult task of bringing to life the memory of a man he had never met, and though he tried gamely, he failed completely. He read from the Book of Psalms. He offered a generic prayer that would have fit a deacon or a serial killer. He offered soothing words to the family, but again, they were total strangers to him. Rather than a heartwarming send-off, the service was as cold as the gray marble walls of the faux chapel. Morgan, with a bronze tan too ridiculous for February, attempted to humor the small crowd with some anecdotes about his old pal. But he came off as a man going through the motions and wanting desperately to get back on the jet. Hours in the Caribbean sun had convinced Morgan that the blame for his disastrous re-election campaign could be placed squarely at the feet of Robert Critz. He had told no one of this conclusion. There really was no one to confide in, since the beach mansion was deserted except for him and the staff of natives. But he had already begun to carry a grudge, to question the friendship. He didn't linger when the service finally ran out of gas and came to an end. He offered obligatory hugs to Mrs. Critz and her children, spoke briefly with some old friends, promised to see them in a few weeks, then rushed away with his mandatory Secret Service escort. News cameras had been stationed along a fence outside the grounds, but they caught no glimpse of the former president. He was ducking in the rear of one of two black vans. 5 hours later, he was by the pool watching another Caribbean sunset. Though the memorial drew a small crowd, it nonetheless was being keenly observed by others. While it was actually in progress, Teddy Maynard had a list of all 51 people in attendance. There was no one suspicious. No name raised an eyebrow. The killing was clean. The autopsy was buried, thanks in part to Mrs. Critz, and thanks also in part to strings pulled at levels much higher than the London police. The body was now ashes, and the world would quickly forget about Robert Critz. His idiotic foray into the Bachman disappearance had ended with no damage to the plan. The FBI had tried and failed to mount a hidden camera inside the chapel. The owner had balked, then refused to bend despite enormous pressure. He did allow hidden cameras outside, and these provided close shots of all the mourners as they entered and left. The live feeds were edited, the list of 51 quickly compiled, and an hour after the service ended, the director was given a briefing. The day before the death of Robert Kritz, the FBI received some startling information. It was completely unexpected, unsolicited, and delivered by a desperate corporate crook staring at 40 years in a federal prison. He had been the manager of a large mutual fund who had been caught skimming fees, just another Wall Street scandal involving only a few billion bucks. But his mutual fund was owned by an international banking cabal, and over the years the crook had worked his way into the inner core of the organization. The fund was so profitable, thanks in no small measure to his talent for skimming, that the profits could not be ignored. He was voted onto the board of directors and given a luxury condo in Bermuda, the corporate headquarters for his very secretive company. In his desperation to avoid spending the rest of his life in prison, he became willing to share secrets, banking secrets, offshore dirt. He claimed he could prove that former President Morgan, during his last day in office, had sold at least one pardon for $3 million. The money had been wired from a bank on Grand Cayman to a bank in Singapore, both banks being secretly controlled by the cabal he'd just left. The money was still hiding in Singapore in an account opened by a shell corporation that was really owned by an old crony of Morgan's. The money, according to the snitch, was intended for Morgan's use. When the wire transfers and the accounts were confirmed by the FBI, a deal was suddenly put on the table. The crook was now facing only 2 years of lighthouse arrest. Cash for a presidential pardon was such a sensational crime that it became a high priority at the Hoover Building. The informant was unable to identify whose money had left Grand Cayman, but it seemed quite obvious to the FBI that only two of the people pardoned by Morgan had the potential of paying such a bribe. The first and likeliest was Duke Mongo, the geriatric billionaire who held the record for the most dollars illegally hidden from the IRS, at least by an individual. The corporate category was still open for debate. However, the informant felt strongly that Mongo was not involved because he had a long, ugly history with the banks in question. He preferred the Swiss, and this was verified by the FBI. The second suspect was, of course, Joel Backman. Such a bribe would not be unexpected from an operator like Backman. And while the FBI had believed for many years that he had not hidden a fortune, there had always been doubt. When he was the broker, he had relationships with banks in both Switzerland and the Caribbean. He had a web of shadowy friends, contacts in important places. Bribes, payoffs, campaign contributions, lobbying fees, it was all familiar turf for the broker. The director of the FBI was an embattled soul named Anthony Price. 3 years earlier, he had been appointed by President Morgan, who then tried to fire him 6 months later. Price begged for more time and got it, but the two fought constantly. For some reason he could never quite remember, Price had also decided to prove his manhood by crossing swords with Teddy Maynard. Teddy hadn't lost many battles in the CIA's secret war with the FBI, and he certainly wasn't frightened by Anthony Price, the latest in a long line of lame ducks. But Teddy didn't know about the cash for pardon conspiracy that now consumed the director of the FBI. The new president had vowed to get rid of Anthony Price and revamp his agency. He had also promised to finally put Maynard out to pasture, but such threats had been heard many times in Washington. Price suddenly had a beautiful opportunity to secure his job and possibly eliminate Maynard at the same time. He went to the White House and briefed the National Security Advisor, who had been confirmed the day before, on the suspicious account in Singapore. He strongly implicated former President Morgan in the scheme. He argued that Joel Backman should be located and hauled back to the United States for questioning and possible indictment. If proven to be true, it would be an earth-shaking scandal, unique and truly historic. The National Security Advisor listened intently. After the briefing, he walked directly to the office of the Vice President, cleared out the staffers, locked the door, and unloaded everything he'd just heard. Together, they told the President. As usual, there was no love lost between the new man in the Oval Office and his predecessor. Their campaign had been loaded with the same mean-spiritedness and dirty tricks that have become standard behavior in American politics. Even after a landslide of historic proportions and the thrill of reaching the White House, the new president was unwilling to rise above the mud. He adored the idea of once again humiliating Arthur Morgan. He could see himself, after a sensational trial and conviction, stepping in at the last minute with a pardon of his own to salvage the image of the presidency. What a moment! At 6 the following morning, the vice president was driven in his usual armed caravan to the CIA headquarters at Langley. Director Maynard had been summoned to the White House, but suspecting some ploy, had begged off, claiming he was suffering from vertigo and confined to his office by his doctors. He often slept and ate there, especially when his vertigo was in high gear and kept him dizzy. Vertigo was one of his many handy ailments. The meeting was brief. Teddy was sitting at the end of his long conference table in his wheelchair, wrapped tightly in blankets with Hobie at his side. The vice president entered with only one aide, and after some awkward chit-chat about the new administration and such, he said, "Mr. Maynard, I'm here on behalf of the president."
"Of course you are,"
Teddy said with a very tight smile. He was expecting to be fired. Finally, after 18 years and numerous threats, this was it. Finally, a president with the stones to replace Teddy Maynard. He had prepped Hobie for the moment. As they waited for the vice president, Teddy had laid out his fears. Hobie was scribbling on his customary legal pad, waiting to write the words he'd been dreading for many years. "Mr. Maynard, the president requests your resignation." Instead, the vice president said something completely unexpected. "Mr. Maynard, the president wants to know about Joel Backman." Nothing made Teddy Maynard flinch.
"What about him?"
he said without hesitation. "He wants to know where he is and how long it will take to bring him home."
"Why?"
"I can't say."
"Then neither can I."
"It's very important to the president."
"I appreciate that. But Mr. Backman is very important to our operations right now."
The vice president blinked first. He glanced at his aide, who was consumed with his own note-taking and completely useless. They would not, under any circumstances, tell the CIA about the wire transfers and the bribes for pardons. Teddy would figure out a way to use that information to his advantage. He would steal their little nugget and survive yet another day. No, sir. Teddy would either play ball with them or finally get himself fired. The vice president inched forward on his elbows and said, "The president is not going to compromise on this, Mr. Maynard. He will have this information, and he'll have it very soon. Otherwise, he will ask for your resignation."
"He won't get it."
"Need I remind you that you serve at his pleasure?"
"You need not."
"Very well. The lines are clear. You come to the White House with the Backman file and discuss it with us at length, or the CIA will soon have a new director."
"Such bluntness is rare among your breed, sir, with all due respect."
"I'll take that as a compliment." The meeting was over. Leaking like an old dike, the Hoover Building practically sprayed gossip onto the streets of Washington, and there to collect it was, among many others, Dan Sandberg of the Washington Post. His sources, though, were far better than those of the average investigative journalist, and it wasn't long before he picked up the scent of the pardon scandal. He worked an old mole in the new White House and got a partial confirmation. The outline of the story began to take shape, but Sandberg knew the hard details would be virtually impossible to confirm, He stood no chance of seeing the wire transfer records. But if it happened to be true, a sitting president selling pardons for some serious retirement cash, Sandberg could not imagine a bigger story. A former president indicted, put on trial, maybe convicted and sent to jail. It was unthinkable. He was at his landfill of a desk when the call came from London. It was an old friend, another hard-charging reporter who wrote for The Guardian. They talked a few minutes about the new administration, which was the official topic in Washington. It was, after all, early February, with heavy snow on the ground and Congress mired in its annual committee work. Life was relatively slow, and there was little else to talk about.
"Anything on the death of Bob Critz?" his friend asked.
"No, just a funeral yesterday," Sandberg replied. "Why?"
"A few questions about how the poor chap went down, you know. That, and we can't get near the autopsy."
"What kind of questions? I thought it was open and shut."
"Maybe, but it got shut really fast. Nothing concrete, mind you. Just fishing to see if there's anything amiss over there."
"I'll make some calls," Sandberg said, already very suspicious.
"Do that. Let's talk in a day or so."
Sandberg hung up and stared at his blank computer monitor. Critz would certainly have been present when the last-minute pardons were granted by Morgan. Given their paranoia, there was a good chance that only Critz was in the Oval Office with Morgan when the decisions were made and the paperwork signed. Perhaps Critz knew too much. 3 hours later, Sandberg left Dulles for London.